From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on Wednesday when Senator Chuck Schumer visited Tinker Nature Park in Henrietta. During a press conference, the senator blasted the U.S. Department of Agriculture for its decision to stop collecting scientific data on bee populations in places like Rochester. Schumer called the decision, quote, dumb, especially at a critical time, for bees. Colony collapse disorder, identified in 2007, has led to significant declines among honeybee populations. And according to a survey related by the Bee Informed Partnership in June, U.S. beekeepers lost nearly 40% of their honeybee colonies last winter. And as reported by WXXI's Noelle Evans, that's the largest reported loss on record. So why does the USDA's decision matter? The Rochester and Finger Lakes region provides nearly $900 million in agricultural products each year, products like fruits and vegetables and honey that are pollinated by bees. Bees have a significant role in the world's food system. In fact, according to bee experts, they have a role in every 3 out of 4 crops produced around the world. So without them, global food production, crop production could also significantly decrease. Senator Schumer and researchers say we need to know why bees are dying off to prevent agricultural crises and public health crises. This hour, an update on bees. We'll discuss the state of the bee population, the latest research, and how to protect bees, including against the use of certain pesticides. I'd like to welcome my guest for the hour. Noelle Evans is here. She's a reporter for WXXI News. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Hi.
First time on the talk show as a reporter.
Very true. Yeah.
So it's nice that our listeners get to hear your voice on this program, in addition to your reporting in the newsroom.
Fair point. Yeah. Thanks.
And Matt Kelly is here. He's an independent journalist and creator and editor of The Bee Report. Welcome back to you, Matt.
Thank you, Megan.
Well, we have a lot to discuss this hour, including Senator Schumer's statements. And Matt, I'll turn to you first. What was your reaction to the press conference and some of the sound we heard from the senator?
I think it was great. I think he made a really powerful statement. I think the most powerful thing he said was, we need to know why our bees are dying off. Without collecting information, we'll never know. And that is true of honeybees and all of the other 4,000 species of bees in the United States.
Are you, we'll discuss why we think the USDA made that decision. I think there's a lot factoring into it. I know, Noelle, you have some sound to share with us from the senator. But Matt, what concerns you the most regarding a decision like this or related decisions as we look at the population declining globally?
Well, the thing that concerns me the most is we're going to be making decisions about the future of our world in an informational vacuum. I mean, without information, how do we make educated decisions? And so pollinators and the flowers that they are connected to are essential to every bit of life on this planet and not just our food system. So without knowledge, how do we make educated decisions moving forward?
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an update on the current state of the bee population? The last time we talked, which I think was June of last year when we were at WEOS, things were not looking so great. The bee population has been declining for the last several decades. And how do things stand today?
Well, so what we talked about last time is that it's kind of like a yes, but answer to that. You talk to any scientist who's studying bees, and it's really a yes, but, because you kind of have to go species by species. We know about... So again, 4,000 species of bees in the United States. We know about, we have done essential research on maybe, I don't know, a handful of those. The honeybees being the species that we know the most about because it's an agricultural, it benefits us agriculturally. We know the rusty-patched bumblebee has been in severe decline and has disappeared from its its original habitat, so that's why it's on the endangered species list. There are 4 other types of bumblebees that are being considered for endangered species status in California. There's a tiny little, I think it's a Perdida, it's called a fairy bee. It's this tiny little desert bee that lives in a flower that's also being considered for endangered status. So we know that bees are declining, and it's not just that individual species are declining, but we're losing diversity of bees, right? So that's the essential issue, because not every bee is going to pollinate. It's not a good pollinator for every type of flower. So while we may still have bees, you know, broad stroke, air quotes, bees, the question is whether or not we have the right bees and the right pollinators to continue the ecosystems that we want to benefit from. Do we have the right bees to pollinate strawberries and blueberries and apples and all those sorts of things?
I don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but I did check the EPA's website before the program today, and they're reporting that reported cases of colony collapse disorder have declined substantially over the last 5 years. They list some data, which I can read. The number of hives that do not survive over the winter months, the overall indicator for bee health, has maintained an average of about 28.7% since 2006-2007, but dropped to 23.1% for the 2014-2015 winter. While winter losses remain somewhat high, the number of those losses attributed to colony collapse disorder has dropped from roughly 60% of total hives lost in 2008 to 31.1% in 2013. So those are a lot of numbers, but overall the EPA reporting that the problem is not as significant as it used to be. Again, I don't want to make this a political discussion, but Matt, what's your takeaway from that statement?
I'm clearly conflicted by it because the EPA most recently has been one of the agencies to undermine science. So it's kind of ironic, hypocritical to start quoting numbers from the particular iteration of this agency. On the other hand, the reason cutting research to the honeybee studies by the USDA are so concerning is specifically because understanding bees or any insect population requires long-term data. So could I believe those numbers from the EPA? Sure, I could, because they're based in a fairly good chunk of time. The problem is the current messenger who it's coming from. So that's where I have, could they be cherry picking and downplaying the current situation just to justify decisions that are being made by the EPA and the USDA? Sure, they could.
And we'll talk about a recent decision by the EPA regarding a pesticide a little later this hour. But first, I'll turn to Noelle Evans, who was with Senator Schumer on Wednesday. And Noelle, why do you think the senator thinks the USDA has made the decision to stop collecting this data on bees?
He gave a few points regarding some speculations that he had, and we do have tape on that we can play.
Sure. Let's listen to Senator Schumer. This is from Wednesday in Henrietta.
Why did the USDA stop this survey? We don't know. There are three reasons, one worse than the next. First reason, they just want to save dollars. If there was something ever that was penny wise and pound foolish, that's it. Second reason, not good. They think they're worried. The people in the USDA in this administration doesn't believe in global warming. And they're afraid if they show that the bee population is declining, it might add to the argument that global warming actually exists. And the third is the worst of all. There is some thought that pesticides and certain chemicals that we use now are killing off our bees. And there's a worry that a pesticide manufacturer got to the USDA and tried to cut this off. That would be disgusting, horrible. But that's what we're worried about. So today I am calling on the U.S. Department of Agriculture to resume their counting and their studying of our bee population. It also helps our local farmers and agriculture to know where the colonies are and where they're not, so they can bring new colonies there.
Also, the senator mentioned that bees have about a 3-mile radius around their hives. And so when he talks about being able to investigate where those bees are dying off and where they are and where they are not, that really has a lot to do with where the land could suffer if those pollinators can't get there.
Mm-hmm. He's not one to mince words. He used the word dumb at this press conference related to this decision. What's his next step, Noelle?
So he said he's going to try to talk to the USDA directly, the secretary there, I believe. And then he said if that doesn't go anywhere, he's going to address it in the budget in September.
Did he mention any more about the pesticides?
He did not. I asked directly if which manufacturers he had in mind, which pesticides. He didn't give a name of a company or anything. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I can't speak specifically to what the senator was talking about, but we do know definitively that the Trade Association for the Pesticide Industry actually wrote, I guess it would be bill or proposed legislation to insert into the farm bill that was passed last year, because it dragged out for so long. I don't remember exactly when it was passed, but I think it was last year. And that language was inserted in the House, the Republican-controlled House version of the farm bill. Now, it eventually got taken out, but basically it would have undercut every ounce of protection that species like bees would have against the impact of pesticides, particularly neonicotinoids. So based on that knowledge and based on the evidence we have there, it's entirely possible that the senator's supposition that the pesticide industry has gotten to somebody in the USDA. That is possible. Do I know for sure? No. So understand that this is drawing a line from dots we do have to one that might exist.
And those with who are local beekeepers who are speaking, amateurs as well as those who have been doing it for a while, mentioned these mites that affect the bee colonies in the winter. And as of, this is from last year, so between January and, oh, this isn't the one I want, but basically over the winter, we lost about, I think it was 17,000 bee colonies, is what Chuck Schumer mentioned at the press conference. And each colony has about, I mean, I'm not one who keeps bees myself, but I believe that's about 1,000 per or more per hive.
Yeah, I think typically a typical hive, if I remember correctly, because honeybees aren't necessarily my specialty and I don't have a hive in my backyard, but I believe run anywhere between like 60,000 bees in a hive. I mean, we're talking
huge numbers. I'm getting nods from our beekeeper on staff, Gary, sitting behind the glass. So
Losing one hive is huge numbers, yeah.
And especially when you consider that 6 mile diameter that they have in that area and what that can do. And the UN released information this week. I think it was, if not the same day, the day after this press conference, that the way that we are dealing with the land, with agriculture, could cause significant food shortages because we're dealing with the effects of climate change, and also we're not able to, what did they say exactly? We are not taking care of the land as we should be in order to keep reproducing more food and so on.
Mm-hmm. And that report that Noelle is mentioning was prepared by more than 100 experts from 52 countries, and that was released in summary form in Geneva on Thursday. And it, quote, this is a quote, a half billion people already live in places turning into desert, and soil is being lost between 10 and 100 times faster than it is forming, according to that report. So that, plus the bee issue. Yes, Matt.
Well, and I was just going to say those two issues are absolutely linked together, because one of the struggles that we obviously have now in agriculture is this. Over the past several decades, we've really come to be reliant on monocultures, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we just basically plow under everything we can see and then plant it in corn or soy. And, you know, I always like to frame this conversation, I grew up in a society that had abundant food because of how we were farming, right? So it's hard to be critical of the fact that I've never faced starvation in my life, right? Like, so I have to be appreciative of that. But what we have found is that over time, the continuation of this industrial monoculture farming system that we have is it's doing really harm, real harm to the planet. And so the monoculture isn't just about creating these deserts of soil, it's also about creating these deserts of habitat, because particularly with honeybees, they are perennial, right? They last year round, so they need continual sources of food. And if all you have is corn, which one doesn't require bee pollination at all, so there's no food source there, where are these bees going to get their food from? Let's go with something else. Let's say that you are planting alfalfa. Yeah, honeybees aren't necessarily super hot on alfalfa, but they could get pollen from it, I would imagine. So, but that's only a certain part of the season. If the rest of the time you've got nothing else happening in those fields, where are these bees getting their food source from? So we have to start thinking. The problem is we haven't been thinking holistically. I have one solution. I'm going to implement it, done and done.
Well, that industrialization of agriculture, unless I'm mistaken, really came about during or shortly after World War II, mm-hmm. Because there was a direct need there. But it is causing significant harm. And when it comes to diversity for what food can bees eat and so on, when I'm going to actually divert from that. But when Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, was talking about this, he brought it up as an economic issue, not as an environmental issue. I mean, that came. He started with the numbers, and then he went into the environmental issue. And traditionally, our economic systems don't really account for the environment. There's a budding field of study that's ecological economics, and that's interconnecting economic theory with ecology, and that's considering these natural systems in the earth with our human needs. And that, I think, needs to be part of the conversation as well. And not to make this political, but this administration is very harsh and very hard line when it comes to immigration. And the UN even stated that food shortages could lead to an increase in cross-border migration.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to having a conversation about bees or food supply, when you look at it in economic terms, Matt, is that more accessible to people who may not fully grasp the environmental effects? Are they more likely to tie onto numbers and things like that because they can see more tangible effects?
I don't know if that is true. I think that's one way to talk about it, and I think it's a very powerful way to talk about it. This idea of ecological economics plays out right here in New York. A recent study from Cornell, I believe it was a couple of years ago, they spent time in apple orchards around here, which is a very smart thing to do, looking at the pollinators there. And typically what folks will do who have apple orchards is they'll bring in honeybees to pollinate the trees, which is a great idea. However, what they found is that it was the native pollinators that don't go more than 100 yards from their nests that actually have a significant impact on the yields in those apple orchards. So while honeybees help, honeybees may also go 3 miles another direction from the apple orchard to get to something even better. So it's these little native bees that don't go farther than a football field from their nests that are really doing the pollination there. So if we understood that and we based our economics on that, it would be a very different story, right? Mm-hmm. I think people, what's really fascinating about bees, we keep saying we don't want to get political in this conversation, which I'm more than happy to do, although we don't have to.
If you would like to, please do.
No.
As the host, I cannot and will not, but.
That is fine. But what I found about bees, and I've heard this across the spectrum talking to people, is that bees are a non-political topic. People mm-hmm. love bees regardless of how you may have voted. And people really latch onto them. The danger with how people latch onto bees is, again, also because they like the fuzzy ones, the big ones that we can see, right? And those only are 50 species out of those 4,000. So it's all those other little ones that you don't even recognize that you think is a gnat or a fly or something else that's landing on your arm and you want to kill, but you probably shouldn't kill because it's doing something good for us. I think people connect with bees in a whole bunch of different ways. I think the economics is a great way to do it. I think showing people bees up close is a really powerful way because it's too bad this is radio, because looking in some of these bees' eyes is just phenomenal. But I think there's also talking about, again, the political ramifications, the technology that we can learn from bees. There's all these different aspects to what these creatures bring to us that we're only beginning to understand. And so people can connect with it in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn back to what you mentioned about monocultures, because we can look at it on the grand scale, globally, or even nationally. But I think we can notice it in our own neighborhoods as well. So I've noticed in my neighborhood, there's a beautiful yard. There's someone that lives in my neighborhood, this gorgeous green lawn, no weeds, no issues. It must take a lot of work to keep it looking that way. But Matt, from a bee's perspective, it may not be the best place for a bee to be pollinating, finding food. Is that true?
Are there flowers there?
A few?
Right, exactly.
I don't want to out my neighbors. So.
You know, and this is one thing that we keep coming up against, because there is also a movement among people to kind of rewild their lawns to make them more natural habitat, which I think is all fine and good. Although I'm a big fan of having a nice open grass space, right? Like, I do enjoy it. It's a great place to hang out. It's a great place for the dog to go, for the kids to run, to kick a soccer ball around. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think if we're going to create these sort of habitat deserts from a bee perspective, we should also be creating habitat abundance in other parts of the things we do. And the thing that's, you know, bees, helping bees is both a huge problem that has to be dealt with on a huge scale, but it's also something that you can just deal with in your backyard. I was at Grassroots last year, and they have their big parking lot where everybody parks and walks in. There was a single milkweed plant that somebody had missed when they had mowed. They just hadn't mowed in a straight line, and so this milkweed was sitting there. There must have been 100 tiny bees on this thing. And so this one plant was making a difference just in this one spot. So just creating these small spaces in our backyard, creating these small spaces in our office complexes, around the city, on bus stop roofs, all these places.
I've been
places.
Reading about that in Holland. They're putting you know, great spaces for bees on top of bus stations. And I think I read on the Bee Report, Matt, where can people find the Bee Report, your publication?
It is thebeereport.com, thebeereport.com.
So on the Bee Report, you can find a couple stories about Papa John's in the UK making pizzas for bees and the tiniest McDonald's in Sweden, which is bee friendly.
Yeah, you'll notice those got tagged as gimmicks on the, so I mean, but what it does, what it, I mean, they are gimmicks, but they are an awareness issue. And
they're driving a larger conversation
exactly.
about the need to make the changes that you're recommending. And our listeners are starting to call in, write in with a lot of questions for how to create bee-friendly spaces around their neighborhoods, their homes. So we'll get to those in our second half of the hour. We only have a few more minutes left with my colleague, Noelle Evans. So, Noelle, what was your biggest takeaway from the press conference with Senator Schumer?
Honestly, I was quite interested in the off topics at that point. However, bees are incredibly important. And what I gathered is that if the USDA doesn't continue this research, my thought is who will? And what can we do with that information if we can access it, if it is accessible from just like a grassroots perspective or approach? If it could be complete because of the way that the USDA, I think in 2016, they adjusted so that anybody who has is beekeeping. Before, they were just doing it for folks who were keeping five colonies or more. Now it's less than that, or it was less than that. How we're going to be able to analyze the information that we do have and find ways of keeping track of what's going on, even if the USDA stops.
Thank you for being here. Noelle Evans,
thanks
a
so
reporter
much,
for WXXI News. Excellent work on your story. You can find that on our website, WXXINews.org. We'll take our short break, and when we come back, I have some questions for Matt about pesticides. I know, listeners, you have some questions about what you can do in your own spaces to help and protect bees. You can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email your question or comment to connections at WXXI.org, and you can find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. Short break, more with Matt Kelly on bees next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with local poet Charlie Cote to discuss his first full-length collection of poems. It's called I Play His Red Guitar. It's dedicated to his son Charlie, who he lost to cancer in 2005. Charlie was 18. The collection itself takes us through the process of grieving and also of celebrating life. It's a collection about transformation. We'll talk to Charlie Cote and the Art of Poetry next. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. I'm talking about bees with Matt Kelly, an independent journalist and creator and editor of The Bee Report. He's joining us for a conversation about pesticides, about research related to bees, about the impact that they have on our global food system, our public health system. And Matt, before the break, I mentioned I wanted to touch a little more on pesticides because
sure.
I know you've posted stories on your website. You've written about neonics. Is that how it's pronounced?
Neonicotinoids, yeah.
Neonicotinoids. Tell us a little bit about what those are and how prevalent they are in insecticides across the country right now.
Sure. So neonicotinoids are the most prevalently, they're the most commonly used insecticide, not just in the United States, but across the globe. They were introduced in the 90s, and essentially what they are is they're a neurodisruptor. So they're, please chemists out there, please forgive me if I get this wrong, but my understanding is that they bind with the neuroreceptors in an insect's neurosystem, and that will disrupt any number of functions depending on the intensity of the neonicotinoid, and I think depending on the actual type, because they bind in different ways. So you have this broad class of pesticide, and then there are specific sort of varieties within that. So you're dealing with anything from disruption of motor function, breathing, flight, smell, tons of reproductive problems that come up. It's made to be chemical warfare against insects, which, again, being fair to the farmers out there and being fair to the people that are producing food for us, you know, dealing with pests and pathogens are a very real issue, and we need an effective way to do that. Again, what we're suddenly discovering is that the things we have been using are being counterproductive to what we're actually saying we want to do. So we need to end up finding new solutions. And so, you know, neonics are, there is presently in the United States a big push in all across the nation to ban the use of these pesticides, of these insecticides, because of the impact they're having on bees.
If you were to go to a Home Depot, a Lowe's, a store like that to buy some insecticides, if you were to look on the back of the bag to try to avoid a product that contains them, what should people be looking for if they're trying to do that?
You should be looking for specific names. Remember how I said that neonicotinoids are sort of this broad category and then you have specific types within it. Instead of me saying them and people trying to write them down and spell them out, I would highly recommend, since we live in such a connected age, Google it. Google neonicotinoids. You're going to see the different types. And then those are the products you'd want to look for within the ingredients list on any of those items. And the thing people should also be aware of is, so the way these, this particular class of pesticide works is it can be sprayed on plants, which is what we typically think of. It can be doused into the soil. It can be coated onto seeds. And then what happens is they're systemic. So it's not like they just stay in one place. They spread everywhere. And then they're persistent. So another study that Cornell did when they were looking at apple orchards is that some bees that they had, they must have been honeybees, because I think they were looking at honey samples and the rate of neonicotinoids within those honey samples. They found that bees within organic orchards had an instant rate of neonicotinoids. And that's because these bees were either going somewhere that had it, or because these farms have transitioned off of those pesticides, they were still persistent in the system that was there in the soil and the plants and all these other things. So
I know there's a push in states like Maine and Texas to try to ban the use of these. What's happening in New York State?
So right now in New York State, there is a bill going, it was introduced in the Assembly and is currently moving through Albany. It's called the Birds and the Bees Act of New York State. I think that's sort of the common title for it. And it's a rather short bill, but the gist of it is that they're looking to ban both the sale and individual use of neonicotinoid products in New York State.
Mm-hmm. I also want to ask you about a different kind of pesticide. This is a quote from PBS NewsHour in July. They covered the EPA allowing farmers to resume a broad use of a pesticide that I'll mention in a moment here. But there were objections from beekeepers citing that chemical industry private studies said that the product is a lower level threat to bees. That's what the EPA is saying. So this is a quote from PBS NewsHour. The EPA announcement is related to
sulfafloxaflor.
Thank you, that.
I'm not sure I got it right, but closer.
It looks right. The latest bug and weed killer defended by the Trump administration, despite lawsuits alleging environmental or human harm. The pesticide is made by Corteva Argiscience, a spinoff created last month in a Dow-DuPont merger. So are you familiar with this pesticide?
Yeah, and I'm learning more about it, too, because that was a new one for me. I think if I remember correctly, that pesticide also acts like a neonic. It's a neurodisruptor. So the impact would potentially be the same. The thing that's interesting about industry studies is that the ones that I have looked at typically focus on honeybees, right? And again, broken record. Honeybees are one of 4,000 types of bees in the United States. They're the only bees that live in hives. They're the only bees that create honey. They're the only bees that are perennial. Every other bee species in the United States is annual. The adults come out, they mate, they lay a brood, they provision that brood, they die off, and then 11 months later, it starts all over again. So to do impact studies on perennial bees that have huge hives and are not living as single mothers in the ground raising their families is very different than studying the impact of those pesticides on the vast majority of bees in the United States, which are doing, dare I say, a significant portion of the pollination of our food system.
Mm-hmm. Related to honeybees, Rich was on the phone earlier and he had a question. He says, the honeybee we are familiar with is the European honeybee, an invasive species. Why aren't we utilizing indigenous bees? Is this a corporate conspiracy? He wants to know.
So, I can't answer that question because I wasn't part of the conspiracy that came up with it. However, what I would say is it's a really great question, right? And it kind of gets back to what we were talking about with Noel about this idea of ecological economics, right? So if we understand how our pollination networks, and that's really the way to think about this, right? We typically think bees go to flower, pollinate. But you really got to think about these networks because different bees associate with different types of flowers, which produce different types of food. If we understand how that network operates, we certainly could leverage. They would be referred to as native pollinators or native bees, not indigenous. We certainly could leverage them. And again, Cornell was found out that that's actually what's happening in apple orchards all around the state here, is that the more native bees you have in your orchard, the better your yield. So we just have to continue to act on that. And a lot of this is, if you think about it, the way that the honeybee industry is moving hives all across the nation for pollination purposes, that's a system with a lot of momentum. And so there have been people who have been trying to introduce, for example, Blue Orchard Mason bees for fruit crops. And they have not had as great success introducing those commercially as honeybees have had, just because honeybees are a completely different animal. And so it's a completely different system. It's not as simple as saying, well, we're going to be done with these bees and do another, because, again, every bee is different. So what are you trying to pollinate? When are you trying to pollinate it?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for your question, Rich. Our next question comes from Kevin. He says, could you comment on the ecological significance of ground bees that live in sandy soils? And he's thinking that a local planned development may remove a habitat for those kinds of bees.
I think that's a great question that I don't necessarily have an answer to, but it could be pretty significant. What we keep coming back to with bees is that, and this is specifically the point, is that we don't know as much about bees as we could or should. And it's moments like this where it's like, hey, we might be developing an area that could have a significant impact on these bees that I know that exist here. That is a moment to really start learning about them. One of the things I was just out in Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
I wanted
June.
To ask you about that.
So we were out there because there's a whole bunch of stuff we can talk about with that. But what's fascinating about that is that people don't typically think of deserts as having a lot of life, right? They're wastelands, right? We can just kind of do whatever we want with them because there's not a lot living there, which is the absolute opposite of the truth. Some of the highest bee diversity and some of the most intense hotspots for bee diversity in the United States are in arid desert climates. And so the concern for people who know, or just, I guess just to get people caught up, the Trump administration decided to shrink the boundaries of this monument, carve it up, and open it up to increased human activity and extractive industries. And so the concern is by doing that, how are you disrupting these bee populations? And as a result, how are you disrupting the ecosystem? So whether that plays out at the level of a national monument or in a neighborhood that's being developed, yeah, the caller has a great question, and it's definitely worth exploring, because we know about bumblebees, we know about honeybees, but I'm not sure about that bee that's nesting in the sandy soil. I'm not sure how much we know about that.
John would like to know, what effect do GMO plants have on honeybees, and can we develop a honeybee-friendly plant?
I don't think we have to, because nature has already done it. One of the most fascinating things about bees is how closely evolved they are with the flowers that they pollinate. It is astounding, and I won't get too wonky here, but it's astounding how much bees have tailored their behavior to get into those flowers and to get pollen from those flowers, and how flowers have tailored themselves to attract the right bees. It is astounding. So nature's done it. We're here. I think the real question is, how do we keep those plants around and how do we maximize that? You know, the only issue that I have with GMO plants when it comes to bees and bee populations has to do with, it goes back to those GMO plants have historically promoted monocultures and monocropping. Do I think they have to? No, I don't think they have to. But that's typically how it's played out. And so that would be the biggest issue I could see impacting bee species and bee populations.
When we talk about rewilding, which is something that both you and Noel had mentioned earlier, and maybe you have a homeowner who wants to have a more bee-friendly yard, where do you start? What's the first thing you can do to rewild your yard, your business, a space that you have ownership of, in order to protect and help bees?
Make peace with the fact that it's not going to look picture perfect? Like, that's kind of what we've gotten into, right? We've gotten to this idea that we need, you know, perfectly mowed grass and linear lines that looks like it's on a postage stamp. And again, like I said, I mean, I think big grassy spaces are great. I think they're a lot of fun, but understand what they're doing and how do we accommodate that. So there's two things that it come. If you're creating space for bees, there are two important things. One, there's the food sources, right? So you want to plant flowers and you want that bees are actually going to be interested in.
What kinds of flowers?
Actually, you know, a lot of the stuff that gets mowed down on the roadside. So like asters and chicory and all really wildflowers, because those are the ones that have evolved with bees. Planting roses doesn't do anything for bees. I know they're beautiful. I know we've got a lot of affinity for them, but again, it's just a pretty desert that bees aren't getting anything out of. So there's creating food sources, and you want to think about doing that year-round. Like, if you only have your flowers coming up in the summer, well, what are these bees doing in the spring, and what are they doing in the fall? So you need to think about that. The other thing is creating space for them to make nests. And this can actually be the biggest challenge, because people don't like patches of dirt. We've kind of developed this thought that patches of soil, bare soil, are bad, which in large scale they can be. But in your yard, patches of bare soil are where these ground nesting bees are going to make their homes. So allowing that to happen, you know, not cleaning out every single bit of debris in your yard, because those are the things that cover the nest. Many bees, there's, you know, we think when we say carpenter bees, we think the big ones that like bore into your home and, you know, you need like a tennis racket to kind of like fight off, right? That's one type of carpenter bee. There are many more types of carpenter bees that are smaller than a quarter of an inch. They're tiny little bees. And the reason they're called carpenter bees is because they burrow into wood and plant matter. So that's where they make their homes. I should back up and I should say that the benefit that roses can have is once you head them, some of these smaller carpenter bees will actually burrow into the stems and make a home in there. So if you're doing that with that intention, brilliant. So it's not thinking, again, it goes back to this idea of what quote unquote perfect is, what beauty is. I think that is actually the biggest struggle with how we manage our lawns and our neighborhoods and all these open spaces that we have in our cities and our towns.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about some misconceptions regarding bees. So say you're hoping to make some changes in your yard, and maybe in your mind you're picturing these bees swarming around. For people who are afraid of bees for whatever reason, maybe they have an allergy, maybe they're afraid they're going to get stung, I do want to address some misconceptions that I learned about last time you were here about the stinging. So there are very few bees that actually sting. Is that correct?
Sure. So first and foremost, I will say if you have an allergy to bees, absolutely 100% be concerned. We don't need your throat closing up and not being able to breathe. So 100% concerned with that. However, that being said, the only bees that can really sting humans and that are known to produce allergic reactions are honeybees and bumblebees. And they're, if you're allergic to one, you're not necessarily allergic to the other, because they're different types of venoms. That being said, what the sting is on a bee is it's a vestigial ovipositor. It's what used to lay the egg, right? So only female bees have them. And so if you think about that as being the sting, if you're dealing with these tiny little bees that are a quarter of an inch, they're, you know, tiny, tiny little, you'd think they were gnats, their sting isn't going to be big enough to break your skin. I mean, people call them sweat bees, and they're the kind that will crawl around and just kind of look at your sweat. They literally are looking for the salt coming off your skin. Some of the neatest bees to have around, and some of the most important pollinators, again, because they don't go more than like a football field's length from their nest. And so they're going to be taking care of all of the pollination right in that immediate area.
Mm-hmm. Scott says, we need to work with the city park system to get rid of the vast expanses of mowed lawn and put in flowers and bee-friendly areas. Do you see any efforts locally to try to rewild municipal areas? I know, I remember Greenovation next door, or Greentopia was working on a project of that nature. I haven't heard an update recently. So, Michael, if you're listening, call us. But what about you, Matt? Do you know of any organized efforts to try to rewild?
Seneca Park Zoo, they are doing a phenomenal job with their pollinator program. They actually have a plot over at RIT. It's the one I've seen most recently. Where, you know, how the road loops around RIT in some of those open areas, they have completely rewilded them with flowers and habitat and space, and they have signs up calling it out. They're doing the Seneca Park Zoo, they're making pollinators part of their conservation mission. locally, which I think is brilliant. And they've been working with the DOT, the New York State Department of Transportation, to do it along highways, which, again, I mean, you think about all the medians that exist out there, all these just kind of, I guess, spaces that are just neglected. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that's a really important thing to talk about, too, and why what the Seneca Park Zoo is doing is so vastly important is because rewilding doesn't mean just letting stuff grow, right? So when I was out in Kansas a couple of years ago looking at native pollinators in the prairies out there, one of the things that was, it's kind of like a, I should have, it's one of those things where you're like, well, I should have realized this, but you have to have somebody explain it to you, is, you know, returning land to prairie doesn't mean just letting flowers and weeds come up, things that don't have, things that still remain a desert for bees. There's a very thoughtful, conscious process to doing that. And so what the Seneca Park Zoo is doing around here is when they are creating these pollinator, these spaces for pollinator habitat, they're being very conscious of the flowers they're putting in. They're being very conscious of them being year-round, a selection of year-round species. So things are coming up at different times. Things are accommodating different types of pollinators, not just bees, but butterflies and all sorts of different types of pollinators. They're very conscious that they are native to this part of the country. I mean, that's a big issue, right? So if you have bees that evolved here with certain flowers and then invasive species come in, it may work, but it may not. So it's, you still got a lot of flowers, but it still may not be working for the bees we're trying to keep around. But the Seneca Park Zoo, hands down, doing a great job.
You're hearing from Matt Kelly, the creator and editor of The Bee Report, as we talk about a recent decision by the USDA to stop collecting scientific data on bees in places like Rochester and the possible impacts that that has. We're down to our last few minutes, our last 10-ish minutes, so there's still time to ask Matt your questions or relay your bee experiences. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Matt, I know you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, you know, I just want to get back to the USDA decision and why that's such an important story to cover. I think what is most concerning about the cuts to that particular study is that funding is perpetually an issue for learning about bees and insect populations. We don't do it. We just don't do it. There was a great article in The Atlantic last year about the insect apocalypse and what we know and don't know. But one of the things that was really clear in that article is that even at a funding level, we have this aversion to creepy crawly stuff. Hmm. Like, we don't value it. We don't think it's important. And so stuff like that doesn't get funded. The other problem you run into is that most funding cycles are a year, 2 years, 3 years. And so to understand the ebbs and flow of an insect population, which means understanding how things are changing over a long period of time, requires stable funding over years. We just don't make this possible. That's one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons that we ended up doing the project, the Bees of Grand Staircase Escalante, the research and film project that I've been working on, is because Olivia and Joe, the researchers we were working with, have done some of the seminal research on bees in desert environments. And yet they can't get funding to do the long-term work that is necessary to understand whether these boundary changes in the monument are going to make a difference, whether increased human activity are going to make a difference. We need to improve funding in this country for basic research. Funding from the federal level for public and private research hasn't changed over the past, I don't know, couple decades, maybe 50 years. It's basically remained the same. Don't quote me on those numbers, but for a fairly long period of time. What we have now are more scientists, more people wanting to do research, so more people trying to cut into this pie. So how do you divide it up? A lot of it goes to biomedical stuff, which, yay, biomedical, highly support that. I love doctors, love healthcare. I think it's great, so we need to study it. But what are we taking, how else are we losing out by dividing up the pie in that way? And so a lot of this research, a lot of the funding also goes to research that's like wow, bang type stuff. Like, look what I'm going to be able to do. I'm the only person who can do this. This is going to change the world. It's going to be awesome. As opposed to, hey, I want to go out and I want to study the ebbs and flows of this particular ecosystem and understand how the natural systems work versus how we're changing them. Because without that reference point, and this is what I can't emphasize enough, this is There are many reasons to love bees and protect bees and to study bees, but one of them is because they are the emissaries for the health of our ecosystems. And so without knowing how natural, untouched, primitive ecosystems work, we have no way of saying whether or not the changes we're making in this world are for good or for bad. We have no reference point. And that's the real issue with this. We need reference points and we just don't have them.
How do you feel about what's going on in New York State? Is there funding in New York State, especially for this area, that's being designated for those projects?
I don't know if there's any concerted effort for funding. I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm. This may be an ignorant question, so I apologize if it is. But when you're going to Utah and you've just come back to study these bee populations and you're filming them, what exactly are you looking for? And what's the takeaway when you come back?
What's the takeaway? Well, so there's a couple things. There are two parts to this project. One was to actually help facilitate the research that needs to happen. So we did a crowdfunding campaign. We're going to do a second one in the coming months because we're now in post-production. So one was just getting Joe and Olivia back on the ground to do the work. And that's really important. So now they're in the process of having the bees identified and being able to look for patterns. But the second piece was, it really goes back to the question of how do you get people to connect with bees? And so we wanted to put a camera, literally put cameras in the face of these bees to get close-up shots, to just show people how amazing and diverse and incredible, exquisite these little creatures are. So we were looking for every opportunity to do that. And part of what we also wanted to show is how serious this is. I mean, we spent 2-3 days up top of a mesa collecting bees with nobody else around. I mean, we had to hike 1.5 miles up every day from our base camp. I mean, this was not walking in your backyard and swinging a net.
I saw some pictures of you straddling canyons and things. So it's,
correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. I mean, so doing this work, again, if people want a sense of how serious this work is and why it requires funding, is you're not just walking around on a street. You're not just walking around through a park, you know, pinning things that you've caught. This is about going to the places that have remained untouched and discovering what is happening there.
For people who don't have the opportunity or the training to do that, there are a couple questions from listeners who want to know how to start a residential hive. Is that something you're familiar with?
No, I would refer them to the Beekeeping Association. I think they're based in Canandaigua. I think it's the Ontario County Beekeepers Association. They're really good.
Gary's nodding yes.
Yeah, no, they're a great association. I've talked with them on numerous occasions, but they're going to be the ones that know best how to do that. But what I will say is this, and I don't want to dissuade anybody from beekeeping. However, this is a thing to think about. Raising honeybees to protect bee species is like raising chickens to protect songbirds. Raising chickens is great, and there's a great reason to do that. But if you're trying to protect songbirds, you need to be focused on songbirds. And those are the things we need to think about. And those are the balance issue we need to think about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need honeybees. They're awesome. I love honey. I put in almost anything I can. They're amazing creatures. If you spend any time at all around a hive without getting stung, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. But what we cannot forget is that honeybees are just outstanding in every sense of that word, outstanding, singular type of bee. The majority of bees are not like them. So while we can learn a lot and we value what honeybees bring us, they are not necessarily representative of the other things we need to do to protect the other 3,999 other species, right?
Mm-hmm. What about the Finger Lakes Bee Survey, Matt? Is that something that is easily accessible to people? They can be involved in some of the research that you and others are doing?
Yeah, so one of the things that people can do is really get involved with citizen science on this, because while there isn't funding that exists to do it kind of on a concerted level, man, how easy is it to walk out in your backyard and just spend 30 minutes just pausing and looking around and taking photos on your smartphone? I mean, I know we like to knock on technology and the connected world, but man, I love it. It's so, being able to take a photo of bees, upload it to a website like iNaturalist or Bumblebee Watch, and then have experts from around the world help you identify these bees, and then they can use that data in their studies to understand populations that they can't get to, is phenomenal. So highly recommend people look into that. And the Finger Lakes Bee Survey is on iNaturalist. It's just a part of that. There's nothing special to do. Just log in, create an account, tag everything in the Finger Lakes, and it'll get uploaded right to that.
survey. Is it just inaturalist.com or?
Inaturalist.org.
.org. That makes sense. Our friends at the Little Theater want you to know, listeners, that a bee-centric movie is opening here next week. So that's Friday, August 16th. Honeyland is an intimate look at one rural beekeeper. And you can find more on the Little's website. And then also just check their Twitter. They just tweeted about it. So lots of, I know you said, Matt, lots of bee-centric movies coming out. Lots of discussion about bees in different ways. Is interest growing among people, or is there a lot of
talk
about bees?
Well, I think awareness.
I didn't want to use the word buzz because I'm trying to avoid puns, but
and
it
yet
did
we
enter
didn't
my
make
mind.
It through the hour. I think there's much greater awareness of people understanding bees and the diversity of bees, and we just need to continue it.
Thank you. Matt Kelly is an independent journalist, the creator and editor of the Bee Report. Where can we find the Bee Report again, Matt?
It is thebeereport.com.
Perfect. And we'll link to that on our website. My thanks also to Noelle Evans, our reporter here at WXXI. Thanks for her excellent coverage of Senator Schumer's visit here yesterday. Matt, thanks as always for sharing your wealth of information about bees. You're an encyclopedia, and I mean that in a very flattering way. I hope you take it that way.
Thanks for having me. I always love it.
Absolutely. Short break, listeners. More connections next.